The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Today we'll be talking about natural science in the liberal arts tradition, from wonder to wisdom, which is an old quote from Aristotle that philosophy begins in wonder and always has. And to begin with, I'd like for you guys to engage with me in looking at a picture and thinking about it together. And I'd like for you to tell me what you see. Okay, picnic table. What else? Okay, good. Sunlight streaming through. Okay. A rock? What else? You guys can just call out. A lot of trees. What kind of trees? Deciduous trees? Okay, good. What can you say anything about the light, the sunlight that's streaming through? Okay, why do you say it's morning? Okay, very good. Where do you guys think this might be? State Park? Okay, good. In America? Somewhere else? Okay, so you think it's here, around here where we are now? So maybe South America, not around here. Why not around here? Okay, so I think what you mean to say by saying it's a state park and they're not planted is that this is a more natural setting. Good. Any guesses where, so I heard South America. Anybody else want to make a Colorado? Okay, good. How does this make you feel? This when you see this picture, can you hear it?
Bug spray.
Okay, bug spray. Good. Relaxed, peaceful. What else? A little bit louder, if you would. Yeah, relaxed, peaceful. I want to go there. Somebody said bug spray. Does anybody not want to go there? Good. Yeah, that's right. So does that make you want to go or not want to go? Some depends on the day. Good. A lot of us, when we see something like this, feel peaceful and excited. I remember after speaking at a conference one summer, I took a vacation with my family up into North Carolina. I love the mountains of North Carolina. They're beautiful. And for me, they're so relaxing, like a little slice of heaven, as John Denver says, right, about West Virginia. Almost heaven, West Virginia. And for me, I perhaps Florida boys, we always go up to North Carolina to get in touch with God because it's peaceful there or something. But it is a special place for me. But as I was pulling in to our cabin for the evening, it occurred to me that not everybody feels the same way that I do about the woods and about mountains and about vistas like this. Part of the reason why I was thinking about this is because we had just given a conference on science. I'm here with a friend, Robbie Andreessen. If you have any questions about biology, please go see him. We did a pre-conference a few years ago for another organization, much like the pre-conference we did for SCL this week on science. And we had been talking about these themes. And it occurred to me that, would it surprise you guys that this picture came from a website called Spooky Woods? I don't even know where this is. But not everybody feels the same way that I do. I feel, when I see this, I feel peaceful and encouraged. And like there is something of the transcendent being revealed to me, but not everybody does. And before 1859, Darwin and the publishing of Origin of Species, Darwin gave a talk, and in the talk, his opening line was, "All nature is at war." And so the question that I have is, does God make the grass grow to provide food for the cattle? Or is all nature at war? how do we see in natural science? C.S. Lewis, in his book Abolition of Man, especially in the third chapter, said you cannot go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent because the street or garden beyond it is opaque. How if you saw through the garden too? But a wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as not to see. In the third chapter of The Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis is very interested and concerned with natural science, and he calls us to consider a new natural philosophy. Imagine a new natural philosophy. He's concerned that in natural science, we've become reductionistic in such a manner that we've reduced things to abstract parts, and that we no longer actually think of things as substantial in and of themselves, disclosing a reality to us that's tangible. And because of that, we're in the habit of seeing through things in natural science. But to see through all things is the same as to have an invisible world, he warns us. And so in this new natural philosophy that he wants us to imagine, he encourages us to hold different things together. And I will summarize those as wonder, work, wisdom, and worship. To buy knowledge, but at a lower price than that of life itself. When we think of an abstraction of a projectile in motion or a river, to remember that it's only an abstraction and not the thing itself, to be able to have wonder at the thing itself, and that all this wonder can lead to wisdom, as Aristotle held, that philosophy always has and still does begin in wonder. And even though in Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis isn't talking explicitly about worship, we can see in all of his other books that he expects the natural world to culminate in praise to God. So what would it look like if we thought of natural science as being surrounded with wonder, work, and wisdom leading unto worship? And what would this look like in a curriculum? Well, work and wisdom are in some ways two very different impulses that we're both called to in the scriptures. In Proverbs, it says to get wisdom. In the New Testament, it says those who do not work shall not eat. You know, or whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your heart. Both are good. One of the ways we have strong differences with the ancient Greeks is that we don't have a low view of the material world and deprecate physical work. We have a high view of it. And so because of that, we want to hold both work, the ability to do work, in high regard, as well as the pursuit of wisdom. But there's also even more deep and subtle reasons why work and wisdom need to be held together. And this is especially true in a natural science curriculum. I'd like to start off with one statement, and we'll explore it throughout the throughout this presentation, and that is I'm concerned that today natural science has been reduced down to merely a form of technology. Another way to put it is that we only learn natural science for work's sake. And one of the first things I think we need to do is to recover this notion that by studying the natural world, we can come to truth. And that truth is a part of wisdom. And we can explore that a little further over the course of the lecture. But that these are actually two distinct endeavors, the pursuit of useful work and the pursuit of wisdom. And even though they're distinct, they are still intertwined in deep ways. Why? One of the reasons why, I think, comes to us from Maximus the Confessor. Now, Maximus is a church father from about the 7th century AD, and he's a very impressive man. He's one of the last founders of Christology, or another way to put it is that what the Western Church, both Protestants and Catholics, believe, and what the Eastern Church, the Greek Orthodox and other Orthodox branches believe. They all believe many things held in common about Christ and the nature of Christ, fully God and fully man, things like that. Well, the last part of the Orthodox doctrine of Christology that all Christians believe in the West and the East was something that Maximus the Confessor had to die for. He was against all the other people holding to the position about how Christ's divinity and humanity plays out in some of the controversies of the day. And they cut out his tongue and cut off his hand for it. That's why he's called the Confessor. And he died from his wounds within months. But about 10 years later, he was vindicated that his was actually the biblical view. And it's what all people, all Christians now believe as part of Orthodox understanding of Christ. And he was very deep within Christian scripture and understanding how the thought of the ancient world culminated in Christ. And this is what he says: true wisdom is acquired only in service, because wisdom is itself a service given to the salvation of the world, and so a divine service. What does he mean there? What is given to the salvation of the world? Or maybe more importantly, who is given to the salvation of the world? Thank you. Yeah, like I said the other day, it's the right Sunday school answer, and it's the right answer now. Jesus, right? Christ, Jesus Christ is the one who is given for the salvation of the world. And what is he referred to in the New Testament? He's referred to in many different things, but one of them is the wisdom of God. That the wisdom of God is given as a sacrifice to the salvation of the world. And so this wisdom is also a divine service. Another way to put it is that we can't actually have wisdom without recognizing that wisdom serves. And moreover, we can't have service without that service itself being wise. And so we find these two twin distinctives in what we ought to do as both wisdom and service, the arts of service and the love of wisdom, as mandates in the Bible, and as held together in some ways inextricably. And yet they still are somewhat different impulses. If I'm correct in my assertion that I think today contemporary natural science is more of a technology and about training students for vocations in those kinds of technology, physics, chemistry, etc., then the question is, where is the pursuit of wisdom in these disciplines? And maybe we have to recover the pursuit of wisdom even for the sake of work. Now, if we look back at the tradition, then we see that natural science was not the only thing in the curriculum. The other things in the curricula that were similar to natural science, that studied the natural world, were natural history, which was always in a conversation with natural science. We'll see a quote by Aristotle soon about how these two disciplines always must interplay with each other. Today, I would assert that natural history has been lost as a discipline, or maybe I should say all but lost. How many of you have heard the term natural history before? Okay, very good. And the first time you encountered the term, might have a guess of where that would be, but would somebody tell me where they first encountered the term? A museum of natural history, right? And today, that's kind of what we think of as a natural history, just what's left in a museum. But yet, for thousands of years, natural history was a living and active discipline. We'll explore what it was, but to start with the idea of a natural history museum is not a bad place to start. It has to do with the observation of things, observation of animals, plants, and even minerals. But natural science and natural history were not all there were. If we were to look at the 13th century or the 3rd century BC, also was natural philosophy. Natural philosophy governed this discourse of natural science and natural history. Philosophy means the love of wisdom, and it's the pursuit of wisdom that comes from the natural world. As you can think of Solomon, who knew so many species of plants and animals, as having a kind of wisdom that would come from the natural world of Proverbs that enjoin us to see the ant or watch the ways of the lion and think about what that maybe ought to reflect on virtues that we could acquire. And that there is wisdom, that when we see the natural world aright, there's wisdom within it. The common arts, on the other hand, are the arts of service. We can trace this word back to the ancient Greeks, again, who would sometimes use the word vulgar arts, but vulgar just means common. In the 13th century and the 12th century, the notion of the common arts was much, much redeemed by Christians, because just like they were interested in the liberal arts that come to us from the ancients, but the common arts, they did not have the same associations as the ancient Greeks did with them being lowly. For the medieval Christians, they had a high view of the common arts. The common arts are the arts of service that work alongside nature, not working in opposition to it. But all of these things are governed by theology, by scripture, and what we learn from scripture and community and from those who have gone before us. Now, how is it that theology governs these things is a question that we will continue to explore throughout. But one of the ways that I think is really helpful is once we start to look at what Lewis wants us to do in recovering natural philosophy, a new natural philosophy, we can see lots of points of contact with scripture that may not have appeared to us when all we were doing is studying natural science without the rest of its context. A philosopher of science named Peter Deer says that science is not two opposed philosophies, but two distinct practical endeavors. Natural philosophy, the goal of which is to make sense of the world, and instrumentality, which aims at creating means of material control. So here's back to that original thesis. We've got both the love of wisdom, natural philosophy on one side, and technology, or the desire to control the material world, or perhaps a better way to think of it is to serve others through instrument, through our work in the material world. But the history of science is in large part the story of how those two, while never quite acknowledging the fact, have interwoven and accommodated themselves to each other. And one of the things that I am concerned about is that this first endeavor, natural philosophy, is being eclipsed by the second, instrumentality, gaining material control. But the truth of that is that even our ability to do work will be lost if we don't recover these other aspects of wonder, wisdom, and worship. And I think this is ultimately Lewis's concern in the abolition of man as well, that if science continues in the same manner it has, going on seeing through things, then it will see through reason itself, and somebody must arrest this process. So let us talk about rediscovering wonder and work first, and then the second topic of today will be rediscovering wisdom and worship. And we'll see how these come together in a fully orbed picture of Christian classical education and the liberal arts tradition. So, not just natural science, but also natural history. Not just the liberal arts, but also the common arts. Let's start with natural history. Owen Barfield was a very impressive thinker. Who knows who Owen Barfield is? Raise your hand if you know who Owen Barfield is. Okay, good. Some of you guys don't know, and I'd be happy to share with you that he had a daughter. He was a friend. He was called the first and the last Inkling. He was a good friend of C.S. Lewis, and in fact, he had a daughter named Lucy, and guess who the first of the Chronicles of Narnia was dedicated to? Lucy Barfield. And so you can imagine that whenever you hear or read the Chronicles and you see the character Lucy in them, that Lewis was very likely thinking of his friend Owen Barfield and his daughter, Lucy Barfield. Owen Barfield wrote a book called Saving the Appearances. He was a brilliant thinker and wrote a book called Poetic Diction, which if you're interested in literature, I encourage you to get. And if you're interested in science, I encourage you to get the book Saving the Appearances. And in this book, he also talks about these themes. He has a very poignant quote in the book which says that there will be a revival of Christianity when on the tongue of every science teacher is the incarnation of the word. Well, he thinks that also that we're losing something in contemporary natural science, and he called the thing that we're losing figuration. He's drawing from the natural history tradition here to see figure in things and not only reduce things to atoms and molecules and their smallest constituent parts. The ancient thinker Pliny wrote a book called Natural History in the early, maybe 100 or 200 AD, I forget the date, and that was a textbook for thousands of years. Francis Bacon, an early modern, also referred to this discipline as natural history. Aristotle calls this discipline the recognition of natural groups, like the class of birds or fishes. Aristotle famously talks a lot about formal cause. He talks about four causes. You may know them as formal, material, final, and efficient. Formal cause can sometimes be understood as the shape or the figure or the aspect, the essence of a thing. And so to recognize formal cause, to recognize the shape, the figure, the essence of the thing, to apprehend its essence, was part of what Aristotle thought was natural history. He also wrote a book called History of Animals. It's probably an interesting time to let you know this word history in the Greek actually just meant inquiry. So a history of animals is an inquiry about animals. Moreover, if we talk about natural history, another way to put it is just an inquiry about nature. So what does it mean to have an inquiry about nature alongside of natural science? How can we cultivate in our students that inquiry approach to nature alongside of natural science, which focuses on demonstrating your knowledge or proofs of your knowledge? We can think about those who have done this focus on figuration, on the observation of form well. People like Leonardo da Vinci at the beginning of kind of the modern natural science tradition, in fact, somewhat a predecessor of it, a precursor to it. He was interested not just in drawing animals and horses, but he's also interested in drawing machines and observing machines. We've recognized that we don't do enough of this in our classrooms in our school, and so one of the things that we've introduced is actually natural history classes. The seniors have an elective they could take called Central Florida Natural History, and the seventh graders now, instead of life science, we've moved to calling that class natural history, and with life science components to it. But take a look at the sketchbook that was compiled of students' work. The sketchbook that was compiled of students' work in their drawings, their learning to draw and observe nature, nature in the raw. Let me drag this over so you guys can see what's going on. One of our teachers, Matt Clark, put this sketchbook together of student work so others could get a sense of, actually that's Matt's drawing, but all these others are student work, so that others, science teachers that were interested, could get a sense of how to do this. If anybody wants to find this, it is available on the internet for a download. You can find it at www.recoverednature.org. You can find a link there. If you search for Matt Clark in the search bar, you can find a link that you can find a place to download this. But the students learned, they didn't necessarily know how to draw very well before coming in. Some of them did better than others, and you can see the ones that knew better than others, right? But they all learned to observe more carefully. Some of you guys may have been in Steve Turley's talk yesterday where he was talking about that once students start to gaze, they can become engrossed in something for 45 minutes or more. And in our Twitter culture, isn't this a need for students to learn how to focus their attention, to learn to observe? So we've been trying to recover this practice of natural history in our students. I can't quite tell if I'm on the X or not right there. Is that it? One of the things that I've done in my classes is introduced a register. Now, I teach juniors and seniors calculus and physics. My junior year class is a double period integrated class where we read primary sources like Isaac Newton, Galileo, Gottfried Leibniz, Pascal, and look at the way that they were making their discoveries in calculus and physics so they could understand the world around them, how that intertwined with their faith in God, whether they had good theology or bad theology. Newton is very interested in God, and at the end of his Principia Mathematica, he writes quite a bit about it. Turns out, though, Newton had pretty bad theology. He was an Arian, and he didn't believe in the Trinity. On the other hand, he was definitely believed that God was the creator of the universe, and all of his work in gravity was showing God. So that's the junior class I teach. The seniors, I teach AP Calculus BC and AP Physics C, Electricity and Magnetism. So they're very high-level classes in terms of my expectations for the student's mastery of material. And yet, on the other hand, I also feel like these human soul-shaping endeavors must be a part of their learning. Otherwise, that we're not going to be pursuing wisdom in our classes. And so in order to do this, one of the things I've introduced is the register. We call it a register of effects. And I have a few here. Because it encompasses both math and science, this year they turned out a little bit more mathy than usual. But it's kind of like a sketchbook, and it's kind of like a log of their discoveries, in some ways like a lab notebook. What I've wanted them to do with it is to follow the practices of the scientists of the 17th century who used these things called registers of effects. The point was to observe and record three things. One, nature in her ordinary course. Two, nature's surprises. And three, experiments, or nature molded by the artifice of man. Now notice that an experiment or a ball rolling down a ramp is artificial. It may not be obvious to everybody at first, but why is it artificial? Anybody want to say it? You can just call out. Okay, we made it happen. Good. Anything else? So it didn't happen of its own spontaneous time. What else? Okay, so the action has started. Anything else about the situation that's artificial? Okay, very good. How many perfectly spherical objects do you encounter in nature? If we go outside and I ask my students to find an object rolling down an incline, it's not very easy to do in Florida, at least. Now, if we were in North Carolina or one of your beautiful states like Idaho or elsewhere, you might be able to find some kind of an incline, but would it be a 30-degree incline that was perfectly, uniform? Would you find a perfectly spherical object rolling down those inclines? This was something that was very clear in the 17th century to people. Now, the experimental philosophy was on the rise, and they valued experiments, and we value experiments too, but it was just important to distinguish an experiment done by the artifice of man, where we're taking nature out of her ordinary place and kind of eliciting some kind of regularity out of her in an artificial environment, to distinguish that from observations of nature in her ordinary course. The other thing in here is nature's surprises. What are nature's surprises? Have you guys ever heard that Hemingway was interested in six-toed cats? And he collected them. That's a surprise. That he was interested in them because they're unusual. And so in the Middle Ages, and especially early modern period, people kept cabinets of curiosities or things that nature did that were sometimes called nature's monsters, things that surprised us, because there is a sense that if we understood these, we would kind of get some insight on the inner workings of nature. So these are the three things that I try to get my students to attend to with their registers. Can I get my students to walk outside and look for motion? So physics, especially my junior class, mechanics, is all about motion. Can I get them to attend to different kinds of motion that are nature in her ordinary course? When rain falls, does it fall straight down? In a driving wind, does it fall at a slant? So a question might arise about the mathematical sciences, and is it authentic to do natural history in it? And I think I'm going to go quickly through this slide, but just to note that Aristotle actually picked up the method of natural history, making observations, and then demonstrating them in natural science. He picked up that method from astronomy. And so he says that we should actually do in biology when studying animals. Of course, biology is a newfangled word. You just call it zoology. When we study animals and their parts, we should do what the astronomers, the mathematicians do, which is to look at the appearances of things, and then from those appearances to discern and discover and discuss their causes until we can demonstrate that those causes are the causes of the appearances that we seek. By the way, if we go back to that title from Owen Barfield, Saving the Appearances, we can see that Owen Barfield is drawing from this long tradition of natural history, looking at appearances, and natural science, demonstrating the causes of those appearances. So in the mathematical sciences, I've told you already that we focus on mechanics in my junior year. And the thesis of my class is getting the students to discover first Newton's universal power of gravity. And once they've discovered Newton's universal power of gravity through their own work, a long line of kind of following through the footsteps of the men of genius in the 17th century, like Galileo and Kepler. Then once they've discovered it for themselves, the basic insights, can they prove it? Can they demonstrate it? Well, in order to get through all this long list of discoveries and proofs, I try to help them focus on different portions, different kinds of motion. So this is where you can see some pictures that we work with early on in the year, different kinds of linear motion, different kinds of circular motion, and we're going to be searching then for causes behind those. Here's a picture of a page from one of my students' registers where she's observing motion in its nature in her ordinary course kind of motion, the water droplets as they splash in a puddle. To some degree, we can discuss whether hitting water with your foot is natural or not. I think it counted in that case. Over the course of the year, as the students would discover these equations, we would fill them in. And this has been a very rich and very interesting way to do this. It's taken me about 10 years or 12 years to get to the point where I could do this in a class. You can imagine that many of you might have a hard time wrapping your mind around what I'm actually doing or how it could be done. I do have some example of student work up here if you'd like to see it after the talk. But right here on the slide, I've got one page of a student's 8-page final exam for this junior class, where she's walking back through all the experiments and investigations that they did this year, and then the proofs that they figured out after their experiments to show through how the natural science was proved was actually a demonstrable cause for the observations that they observed. And so this is just kind of the kind of thing that this young lady was doing for 8 pages, so I just gave you an example page. A long and interesting process. So natural history and natural science participate in a conversation governed by natural philosophy. I think one of the dangers that we have today is that we've taken natural history out of this conversation. Now let's talk a little bit about recovering work in the common arts, not just the liberal arts. Does anybody know where we get the word school from? We get the word school from the Greek word skole. And does anybody know what skole means? It's now up on the slide. For leisure in Greek is skole, and in Latin is scola, the English word school. The word used to designate the place where we educate and teach is derived from a word which means leisure. School does not properly speaking mean school, but leisure. Isn't that astounding? This is from a book in the mid-1900s by a guy named Joseph Pieper, a German philosopher who's encouraging people to go back into the Western Christian tradition, and especially Germany in post-World War II in their rebuilding. He's saying, I know now does not seem like the time to be focusing on leisure, but if we would like to rebuild our country and our German culture, I think we should do it in the Western tradition. And if we're going to do it in the Western tradition, we need to think about this word leisure, because leisure is the basis of culture. It's at the heart of our understanding of what it means to rebuild culture. Why? Because what we think of as school or education was founded in leisure. And this is why the liberal arts are actually a very important thing for us to recover. What does it mean to have learning that is lovely, wonderful, attractive, and enlarging the mind in such a way that the kids want to do it and are attracted to it? On the other hand, the liberal arts have a counterpart in the common arts. Servile work, or the artes serviles, and liberal arts are twin expressions and form, one might say, the articulation of a joint, so that the one is hardly intelligible without the other, for it is barely possible to think of servile work with any degree of accuracy without delimiting the sense with reference to the liberal arts. So if we're to understand what work is, we actually have to understand what leisure is. What does it mean to not work? The Lord God gave us the seventh day for man, for rest. The Sabbath was intended for man, Jesus says. Think about those cultures that don't have the Sabbath, that don't have the seventh day for rest. It was typical among cultures where they enslaved people, and they made them work 7 days a week. It is just exhausting. And what does it mean to learn in rest? Well, if we're to understand good work, we must also understand good rest. Learning for work and learning for leisure are two different impulses. And they've been very historically rooted in Western Christian tradition. So besides natural science and natural history, which we've already talked about some, there's also natural philosophy. When the liberal arts lead to wisdom, natural philosophy. But when the liberal arts or knowledge leads to work, we get the common arts, the artes serviles, or the common arts. All of this governed by theology. If you want a quick definition of the common arts, it's the arts of service that conform to nature and God's calling and do not oppose them. It's helpful here to think about the arts of the elves versus the arts of the orcs. And by the way, I see some of you guys maybe taking notes and worried, wanting to take pictures of the slides. That's great if you want to, but I also want to let you know that you can download this PowerPoint at www.recoveringnature.org. Recovering Nature, RECOVERING, recoveringnature.org. And you can find it there. The common arts seek to conform to nature and God's calling, not oppose them. The arts of the elves, there was certainly a kind of art and intelligence and brilliance to them. They could get things done. They had military arts, and they had all kinds of fantastical things. You could think of the cloak that was a form of technology, if you will. But the arts of the elves, if you think about their architecture, comported with nature instead of fighting against nature, where the arts of the orcs and the wizards were always set in antagonism to nature. C.S. Lewis says it like this: "For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality, and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. The solution is a technique, and in both, in the practice of this technique, are ready to do things hitherto regarded as disgusting and impious, such as digging up and mutilating the dead." You know, Mary Shelley, when she was writing Frankenstein, she stood right at the beginning of this period where people were starting to throw away this notion that there was a wisdom in nature that we had to imitate, and starting to say, no, we should pursue knowledge for the sake of power, not knowledge for the sake of wisdom. This is a theme coming from Francis Bacon. And so the whole book of Frankenstein is kind of a comparison. You can see natural history in there because natural history, and I think it's Elizabeth, who was one of the characters in the book, would look at the mountains just for their loveliness, while Victor Frankenstein, wanted to look at the natural world so he could control it. And he was ready to do things hitherto regarded as impious, such as digging up and mutilating the dead. If we look back at the beginning of this, we can see an inversion happening. The wise men of old saw reality as fixed, given by God, and they had to conform their souls to the reality given by God. What began to happen with modern science was an opposite impulse, where reality was no longer something given, but it was a blank slate upon which our wills were there to dominate reality. The question became how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. What are the limits of technology? I'm very concerned these days with all the things that are happening in the news with artificial intelligence, you could say killer robots, issues of end-of-life issues, biotech issues with things like... One thing I'm very concerned about is forced organ transplants that are happening in other parts of the world, but I think maybe on a genocidal scale. But we're starting to... If men are merely matter, if things are merely material, are there any limits to the wishes of men over that matter? What are the limits of technology? Even the people in places of power throughout the world are highly concerned about this. "Stop killer robots before it's too late," scientists tell Davos Forum. Davos Forum is the World Economic Forum that happens in Switzerland. And there's a concern that technology is itself getting away from us. Why? I think the reason why is because we're not aware of how nature herself has an order and rhythm that we need to obey, or I should say need to submit to, as C.S. Lewis calls it. The common arts actually come to us from the late medieval period, codified as corresponding precisely to the seven liberal arts. So if you look at that left column, tailoring, weaving, agriculture, architecture, warfare, trade, cooking, blacksmithing, this is quite a list. Now this list, if you think about it, is about 70% of the American economy. It's the kind of things that we need to keep clothed and sheltered, to keep food on the table, to protect ourselves in case of attack. The common arts are the arts needed for a civilization, the arts by which we serve each other. And these were held up as just as important as the liberal arts. Hugh of St. Victor was the person that wrote that list. Dante also gives us some more understanding for the rhythms of the common arts. "Philosophy points out to him who understands it how nature takes her course from the divine intellect and from its art. And if thou note thy physics well, thou wilt find, after not many pages, that your art follows her so far as it can, as the disciple does the master, so that your art is, as it were, the grandchild of God. Nature takes her course from the art of God, from the divine mind. And if we imitate nature, God has put rhythms and wisdom in nature. If we work alongside of her and not against her, then we are imitating the wisdom and structure that God has put into the warp and woof of nature, so that therefore our arts, when we create things, are the grandchildren of God's art. I love that. You've heard the quote before, art imitates nature. But we also often just think of it in terms of visual art or fine art. But the term art for the ancients and medievals was a much broader term. Anything done by the reason of man, anything done by the artifice of man was an art. And so this idea was much broader. Art imitates nature in all of its forms. And so this is what we're talking about with the common arts. Well, in our last 10 minutes, I'd like to touch upon wisdom and worship. We don't have a lot of time for this, and it's a shorter part than the beginning anyways. But I'd like to at least have a chance to think about ways that natural science can recover wisdom and worship. And I'm going to skip over some of these slides, but you can look at them on the online if you'd like to look at them more. And I'm going to focus on the ones that I think are most important. So the big questions here are about how do the maths and sciences fit in with the whole curriculum of your school? Math and science tend to be isolated as disciplines, and then the humanities we think of as the soul-shaping endeavors. Math and science tend to be only thought of as for vocational preparation, so that people can do useful work. And this is what I mean when I say that science has been reduced down to mere technology. And we tend to, especially in our schools, we tend to think of the humanities, the places where they really learn about truth. Or another way, and so when we start talking about truth too much in science, I think there's some concern and some worry that that might actually be undermining the way we talk about truth in the humanities. And I think that's historically been the case in education in the past 100 years because of scientism. So how do we do science and math education without scientism so that science and math can actually lead to wisdom? And part of this has to deal with the question of what is the relationship between faith and reason? Well, some things that I will offer as suggestions that will help are to let the narrative of discovery guide math and science classes. Now, I'll focus on science now. For my juniors, we have a lot of people will do physics that covers five big topics in introductory physics. Those topics would be mechanics, optics, thermodynamics, electricity and magnetism, and modern physics. And they might do that in a junior year or some smattering of those. We've decided to take a different approach and to only take mechanics, but to go deep with it. And if we go deep with that one topic, mechanics, at a college level, and which, by the way, is a semester-long class in college anyway, so it's appropriate to take a year for it, then the thesis of that class is Newton's universal power of gravity. How did Newton come to assert that gravity is a power that's universal, that governs the planets as well as pulls stones towards the Earth? Well, it's not. Most times when I had taught it before, I just taught it, Newton is a genius, he figured this out, you know, isn't this amazing? Great, now let's do it. So what does it look like to have the kids reason to it themselves, following the narrative of discovery? It takes both the experiments, the investigations, and it takes the proofs and the theoretical work. And doing those in tandem allows a narrative to emerge. When you teach along that narrative arc, it gives you more opportunities to discuss wisdom and why Newton made these why he made assumptions like absolute space and time, and were those assumptions like absolute space and time correct or false? Of course, Einstein thinks that Newton is making bad assumptions there, and yet they influence all of his physics. In chemistry, the periodic table of elements can form a good thesis so that the students can come to a narrative of discovery along that. And in biology class, one thing that Robbie Andreessen up here does, and you can talk to him about it, is how does Darwin come to understand evolution as the cause of all these things? And just like Einstein had a different word over absolute space and time than Newton did, so contemporary thinkers in the 20th and 21st centuries have strong critiques of Darwin. So it's not just Darwin, but it's Darwin and his critics. So looking along that narrative arc gives an opportunity to allow the kids to discover things, to work on that wisdom, but to do it in a way that also can be governed by theology. Now, we read, I'll go through this quickly to just tell you that we read primary sources and for technical narrative, and we read secondary sources, and we use textbooks. And we use these readings for both the narrative of discovery, to read about the faith and the wisdom of the great scientists, and to think about the transformation of culture through those discoveries. Steve Chapin wrote a good book called The Scientific Revolution, which is a great secondary source reading for some of this stuff. Poetry actually can show up pretty well when you get into these narratives, because often poetry gets this the big insight or the big topic more quickly than natural science does. Poetry gets the hypothesis before natural science demonstrates the hypothesis. One way that I think this is shown is through the poem In Memoriam, where In Memoriam is struggling with the question, which is nature red in tooth and claw. Nature red in tooth and claw. Is nature red in tooth and claw? This was written before Darwin, not after him. And about 10 years before Darwin, you can see that the poets are asking this question, is all nature at war, or is love creation's final law? And it matters what we think about this, because it matters how we see. I probably don't need to convince you. I might need to convince you that science and poetry are intertwined, but I probably don't need to convince you that science, logic, and mathematics are intertwined. I'll only say this, that we do teach in junior year the double period integrated mathematics and physics, calculus and physics, because calculus was discovered in the context of the discoveries of physics. So keep together what was discovered together. We'll finish the next last few minutes with talking about how theology can govern natural philosophy. One of the most important conclusions that I've come to in teaching in this manner is to recognize that truth includes mystery. I used to think that as we learned truths that in science or elsewhere, that they would push mystery further out to the boundaries. But what I've discovered is that the more truth we learn, the more mystery is included. When I teach my students, I refer constantly to these three mysteries: the divine mysteries and the natural mysteries. The divine mysteries of the Trinity, the Incarnation, and the New Covenant, or God's covenant of love, or God's covenant of grace in Jesus, I think are reflected in mysteries that everybody has to struggle with. We saw Plato, you can see Plato in the ancient world struggling with the one and the many, form and matter, or soul and body, and with determinism and free will. I think that the question of the one and the many, for example, at the heart of the scientific revolution is this issue of atomism. What is fundamental in reality, the atoms or the things themselves? For example, Descartes famously thought that animals were just basically made up, since they were made up of atoms, they were not more, anything more than machines. And so whatever you wanted to do to animals was fine, because they were essentially machines. They didn't have anything more. They didn't have a form. Natural history was on its way out. But if things are one as well as many, then they have a form as well as matter. And these are, I think, but distant echoes of the mysteries of the Trinity and the Incarnation. How can God be gracious to us sinners? Even how does our human responsibility play into God's free, into God's sovereign will? These are problems and questions that atheists have to deal with in their own way. Are we wholly determined by chemical forces, or do we have a free will? And so you see these things come up even in physics under the guise of questions of natural law or other aspects. Today, there's a lot being made of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and chaos theory, and how do these form kind of two sides of a conversation that is even going on in explanations of motion of bodies, even the motion of the planets, to be honest. So for me, I've gotten a lot of work. I've gotten a lot of opportunities to push my students towards Christ by talking about the natural mysteries and how the natural mysteries show forth the divine mysteries. We see this in lots and lots of work. And I will skip over these next two slides to just kind of tie us together with culmination. You cannot go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent because the street or garden beyond it is opaque. So, as we think about natural science and how to teach it in a different way, let's consider how we can recover wonder through the natural history, work through the common arts, wisdom, by letting natural philosophy govern the conversation, and all under theology, showing forth how these mysteries that arise in nature actually point to the greater mystery of Jesus Christ. So if we have, we're probably just about out of time, but I'll take one or two questions, but thank you very much for your attention. If anybody has any questions, you're welcome to, or you can just come see me up afterwards. Yes, ma'am. What did you, when you did www.recoveringnature, it says you need a password. It should come up without a password. There is some things that are password protected, but not everything is password protected. Did you go to the homepage? Did you go, are you doing it in a mobile format? You might need to do it on an actual computer because the mobile format's a little bit wonky. Yeah, that might be it. Okay, thank you very much.